Well, I want to start with the immortal words of Don Vito Corleone, and I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. Are you sitting comfortably? It's a no-brainer, really. If you value all that is good and wise in the world, all that is sensible and proper, it's going to be a complete cinch, just like the Don's offer. It's obvious which way you should go. In fact, you won't even have to think about it. Which is why it's so astonishing that so many people don't pick the obvious one. So here's the offer. Do you want to be a slave or free? That's the offer. Do you want to be a slave or free? No brainer, don't you think? It's an easy decision. It's obvious which one you'd want, isn't it? I mean, who wants to be a slave? Freedom. Freedom, that is the bedrock of Western culture, isn't it? I mean, wars have been fought over it, revolutions provoked by it. Isn't that what the recent extraordinary events in North Africa have been about? People are exhausted by years of dictatorship and oppression. They want to be free. So, slavery or freedom? It's a no-brainer. We all want freedom. It's easy. Or so you would think. One of our problems, I think, is that we don't really understand freedom in our culture. And what we expect to make us free so often actually enslaves us, doesn't it? We think freedom is about being able to do whatever I want, when I want, how I want. As someone once pointed out, in modern life, those things that teenagers do to express their freedom, tobacco, alcohol, drugs, and pornography, become their relentless masters. But it's unfair just to blame it all on teenagers. It's true of us all. We think we're being free as we reject the greatest offer of freedom in history. God's offer of freedom. The freedom that comes from forgiveness. And if that's puzzling, well, the Apostle Paul thought it extraordinary. He can barely believe it, which is why he writes the letter to the Galatians. So as we pick up the letter after our few weeks break, remember that these people, these Galatian Christians in what is now sort of northern Turkey, these Galatian Christians have been gripped by the teachings of the so-called Judaizers, those who insist that Gentile converts to Jesus should keep all the demands of the law. Not just any law. The Jewish law, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, Genesis to Deuteronomy, God's foundation for God's people, Israel. And that's the point. It's come from God. So it stands to reason that you would think, well, if we're following God, we must follow it. And then, of course, Jesus comes along, Jesus the Messiah, Jesus the Christ. He's fulfilled it all. And in fact, he is God incarnate. Which means that these books, Genesis to Deuteronomy, were his idea in the first place. It's his revelation. So to insist that if you follow Jesus, you must follow the Pentateuch was a perfectly logical and persuasive argument. So why on earth does Paul get so heated? I mean, you don't have to read through much of the letter to pick up that the steam is coming out of the apostles' ears. Almost from the very first words. Well, for Paul, it's all to do with where true freedom is to be found. He's terrified that these young believers want to revert to slavery. So in just the bit just before our passage, chapter 4, verse 19 and 20, he says it's like for him, it's like giving birth all over again. He thought they'd already been born again. But recent events suggest that he's got to take them through the whole conversion process all over. My dear children, for whom I'm again in pains of childbirth until Christ is formed in you. Now, Paul's argument here is notoriously tricky. And I've been sort of sweating over it over the last few days. And I'm very open to suggestions and conversations afterwards if I've missed things. And I can sort of put edits or rewrites on the blog over the week if necessary. But please follow closely, because even though this is a complex passage, I think its point is very clear. And it's a matter of life and death. Paul puts himself into the Judaizers' shoes, tries to sort of understand their argument so that he can deal with them. And you see, they insist on going back to the law, to the Pentateuch, to argue their case. And Paul says, okay, let's do just that. And he's clearly identified the flaw in their argument, and that's what we need to understand. You see, these Judaizers, they go back to Moses and the law revealed to him, the Ten Commandments and the law as explained through Exodus and Leviticus, revealed on Mount Sinai. That is their supreme authority and source. But hang on a minute, says Paul. Moses didn't come first. Abraham did. You see, it's all a matter of who your true ancestor in the faith is. So that's why he begins in verse 21. Tell me, you who want to be under the law, are you not aware of what the law says? He says, look, okay, if you want to take the law seriously, let's take the law seriously. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by the slave woman, the other by the free woman. Now, to understand what this is all about, we need to see that it's all about the facts and figures of God's purpose in creating a people in the first place. There's some basic general knowledge that Paul's got to get clear. So he starts with the key facts to get clear. So the facts are these. There are two mothers and their sons. And that's just the first little paragraph there in our passage. Now, our modern fascination with family trees and genealogy and all of that is nothing new. I mean, I suspect BBC One's Who Do You Think You Are would have been just as much a hit in the first century as it is in the 21st. Because, you see, there's always been this sense, down the generations, across the cultures, there's always been this sense that our ancestry does, in fact, shape us in all kinds of even unexpected, if not unconscious, ways. I mean, that's why the BBC program is so gripping, because you see people finding out things about themselves that maybe explain things they hadn't understood before. Well, it's very true of us. It's very true of people in the Bible. And it's no wonder that Paul is concerned to get the family tree facts clear. I suppose the surprise is that here he is writing to a predominantly Gentile church, and yet feeling the need to clarify Israel's family tree. But as we'll see, he knows exactly what he's doing. Now, we all know that, of course, that being Jewish is all to do with who your parents are. I mean, it's basic general knowledge. And we all know that basic general knowledge means that Gentiles are therefore, by definition, separated from Israel by birth. So what on earth has this Jewish family tree got to do with non-Jews, Gentiles? It's a good question. Now, I suspect that the majority of us in this building tonight, by no means all, but the majority of us in this building will, I guess, be from a Gentile background, which means this is actually quite an important question for us too. Now, if we go back to the top of this family tree, who do we find? Well, not Moses, but Abraham. And what happened to him? Well, we heard something of the story in our first reading. God had promised Abraham fatherhood, a family as numerous as the stars in the sky, and that was fair enough. But Abraham was pretty ancient, and more to the point, so was his wife Sarah. And after waiting a few years, no children appear. Things are not looking good. So they take matters into their own hands. They can't quite believe that God is going to sort it out. So they arrange for old Abe to sleep with someone younger, Hagar. And eventually she does provide a son to this 86-year-old dad, Ishmael. Now, according to verse 23, do you see there? Ishmael was born in the ordinary way. Now, in other words, it means that he was born as a result of the same old biological processes of sexual intercourse. Absolutely normal, no surprises the way it's been done from the dawn of time. But then something amazing happens. You see, God shows Abraham and Sarah how foolish they've been. Understandable, but foolish. Because you see, if God makes a promise, he keeps it. Even if that goes against all precedent, all expectations, all experience. You think, yeah, right, what? Don't doubt him. God says, look, I promised you a family, so I'm going to give you a family. And sure enough, Sarah is soon pregnant and gives birth to Isaac. It was a miracle. Which is why in verse 23, Paul says that Isaac was born as a result of a promise. God intervened. Yes, there was still the normal processes of biology, but to enable a woman long past the menopause to conceive, God acted. And that is what marked Isaac out from Ishmael. Same dad. In fact, it was the only thing that marked them out. God's promise. That's what made the difference. Everything else was ordinary, but the conception came about as a result of God's miraculous fulfillment of his promise. Remember that. It's going to be crucial as we go on. Now, at this point, some people get carried away by the idea of genealogy. They say, yes, Isaac's descendants, yeah, that's the Jews. Ishmael's descendants, yes, that's the Arabs. And the conflicts and tensions between the two date back from this time. And it's certainly how many Muslims and some Jews understand it today. But for our purposes tonight, it's worth noting that there is both little evidence for Ishmael being the sort of ancestor of the Arabs, but it's also a point totally irrelevant to what Paul is wanting to say in this passage. So far, so good. There are the facts. You can see them on the screen. But then, in verse 24, Paul does something very unexpected. He says that these facts may be taken figuratively. And at that, some alarm bells get heard, while others rub their hands in glee. Now, what Paul does here is perfectly legitimate, albeit rather unusual. And it's certainly not necessarily a model of Bible handling that we should be too quick to copy, simply because it is fraught with danger, although in his hands it's absolutely fine, as we will see. But what Paul does is to use the subsequent story of these two families descended from Abraham as an illustration. A metaphor, an illustration of how God and his gospel works. In effect, he uses the whole of Israel's subsequent history as a parable to help the Galatians understand which family they're in. And that's the question we need to think about. Which family are you in? There's a great moment in one of the early Simpsons episodes when Homer and Bart and a couple of others end up in a dinghy drifting out to sea, as is their wont. And Homer is a complete fool, as ever. He wastes the remaining water they have by washing his socks. And he eats all the rations. Eventually, they see a rescue plane flying overhead, and it's fantastic. So Homer fires a flare, but unfortunately, it hits the plane. And then suddenly the fog comes right down and they're completely surrounded, you can't see anything, and Homer gets into an hysterical panic. We're doomed! And then the fog clears and suddenly they see a boat drifting into view. Are you okay? Someone shouts. Now, being the typical man, Homer won't admit his need. So he shouts back, yep, everything's fine! The fog closes in again, the boat disappears, and Homer returns to his panic. Now, that's crazy, isn't it? But isn't that a bit like the Galatians? And like us? Crazy, but accurate. In the face of rescue, too proud to ask for help. Now, at first sight, the way Paul develops his argument does seem odd, but it does make sense, and to grasp it, which of their ancestors did the Galatian Judaizers obsess about more than the rest? Well, we've already hinted at it. It was Moses. And not unreasonably, Moses was a remarkable man. He led the people out of their Egyptian slavery. He received God's commandments personally on Mount Sinai. He was a descendant from Abraham. He was the God-given leader of God's people to proclaim God's law. I mean, you cannot get more serious than that, can you? But think back to that diagram, to that table. By rights, which column would you expect Mount Sinai, as the story develops, to be placed in? In the Hagar and Ishmael column or the Sarah and Isaac column? Now remember, Moses is descended from Sarah and Isaac. He receives the law on Mount Sinai from God. So you would think Paul would put Sinai in that column. But look at verse 24. These covenants may be taken figuratively, for the women represent two covenants. One covenant is from Mount Sinai and bears children who are to be slaves. This is Hagar. Huh? But he goes on. The red column gets longer. Now Hagar stands for Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present city of Jerusalem because she is in slavery with her children. Hang on a minute, that's completely up the spout. You can almost hear the Judaizers jumping up and down. You can't be doing that. Do you see why that does not make sense? Sinai is in the wrong column. But then look who he contrasts it with in verse 26. He contrasts Sinai and the earthly Jerusalem who are enslaved. He contrasts them in verse 26 with himself and other preachers of the gospel of Jesus Christ. But the Jerusalem in verse 26 that is above is free, and she is our mother. It's all very strange. And I completely understand. If this is your first time in All Souls tonight, you're probably thinking, whoa, what is all this? I really sympathize. But it is actually very important. So please just bear with me and stick with it. You see, this is Paul's point. He says, look, you can either stick with our gospel if you want to be like us, if you want to be free, or you can follow the Judaizers and become enslaved. Which do you want? It's a no-brainer, isn't it? An offer you can't refuse. It's obvious which one you should choose. Who wants to be a slave? And yet, the Galatian Christians seem to be choosing the red column. Now, the determining factor is how you understand Mount Sinai and God's law given there. In other words, who do you focus on first, Moses or his ancestor Abraham? Let's go back to the fork in the road idea. You can have lots of people traveling along the same road, but when you reach a fork, a decision must be made, left or right. Up until the fork, the crowds have all been going together. But at the fork, there will be a division. They will split. Some will go off to the left. Some will go off to the right. Now, Paul is saying that the Judaizers' track was the wrong fork. You've taken the wrong road. You see, by making Gentiles who follow Christ think they have as well to go back to Sinai, Paul is saying you're taking them on a dead end. They didn't need Sinai in that way now, not to be saved. Because Jesus has fulfilled everything in the law. Everything in the Pentateuch from Genesis to Revelation. Jesus has fulfilled it. How has he done that? Well, by fulfilling all God's purposes and above all his promises that were revealed there. You see, God promises to save people who trust him. And it's always been like that. And trust is the key. You see, I don't know what you think as you came here tonight. I don't know if you've been to church many times or perhaps this is your first time. But there are a lot of myths out there. You see, one of them is that God saves people who are good. God does not save people who are good. He never has. God does not save people who deserve it. He never has. God does not save people who impress him. He never has. He saves people who trust him. That's the way he always has. And that was the way that God saved Abraham. Just flick back, it's chapter 3, verse 6. So just turn back a page. And you'll see what Paul says. And he's actually quoting from Genesis. Okay, to make the point. Going back to the law, if you want to go back to the law, let's do it. So this is what he does. From Genesis 15, he quotes in Galatians 3:6. He says, consider Abraham. Well, folks, that's what we're doing. We're considering Abraham tonight. What happened to him? Well, he believed God. He trusted God. And it was credited to him as righteousness. Understand then that those who believe are children of Abraham. Do you see? And this is the really radical point he's making. You see, Moses was a child of Abraham, yes, but not because he was descended from him, but because he trusted in God. And the law on Sinai was given by God to saved people who already trusted him. Obedience was the response of people saved by grace. So Moses, by this definition, is a son of Abraham because he trusted God, not because of his genetics. And Paul, likewise, Paul was a son of Abraham, again, not because he could claim a perfect Jewish pedigree, although he could, but because he trusted God. And in the New Covenant era, trusting God means trusting Jesus. Trusting him to be saved by grace. So you see, Jesus is the fork in the road. What you do with him now determines whether or not you'll be enslaved or free. So here's the rub. It means that you can be a faithful Jew, seeking to live out life according to God's revealed covenant. And if in your desire to be faithful to him, you live according to his boundaries and directions, but then find that living God's way in his world is the perfect way of freedom, until Jesus comes, that's fine. But when he comes, in fulfillment of that old covenant, he does for us, that is Jesus, what you and I could never do for ourselves. He deals with our sin once and for all by dying on the cross. And that makes all the difference. We now have no need of the old ways, the old boundary markers, the whole sacrificial system, because he's done it all. Because of his grace, we must instead trust him. We must have faith. And that is what this rescue is all about. Or to use Paul's illustration, this is the way of Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac, and not the way of Abraham, Hagar, and Ishmael. Two families. One in the ordinary way. One by promise. But once Jesus has come, you see, what happens? What are we saying if we go back to the old way? Aren't we then saying that we're adding to what Jesus has done for us? Aren't we making Abraham's original mistake with Hagar? I mean, what happened? You know, Abraham, he tried to take things into his own hands. He found it hard to believe that God really would fulfill his promise to give him a family. And so he takes things into his own hands, sleeps with Hagar. They have a son, all well and good, but no, it's not the way God said. And by doing the same thing, by taking things into our own hands, we are effectively saying, I don't really believe that Christ dying for me is enough. Of course, there's another side to our disbelief, just like Homer Simpson refusing help when it was offered. It does offend our pride when we can't contribute at least something. There's a story of the brilliant playwright George Bernard Shaw. He was storming out of a Christian meeting because a preacher was explaining the cross in clear and simple terms. Jesus died in our place to wipe away our guilt, to give us hope for the future. He died that I might be forgiven and rescued. But this was too much for Shaw. He stormed, leaving the building, shouting at the top of his voice, I'll pay my own debts. He went on to write about what he called Christianity, which he decided was an aberration of pure Christianity, a religion that has a Messiah who needs to die on an instrument of torture, punished in our place. He saw that as something utterly to be despised. Christianity. You can almost hear the spit as he says it. The problem is that Christianity, if we have to use that word, is precisely what the New Testament preaches. It's precisely why we're gathering around this table this evening. Because the cross is the only way we have to escape our slavery to sin. But if you add to the cross or undermine the cross or sideline the cross or even ignore the cross, you actually destroy its power. For you're effectively saying it's not enough. Or that we can do enough to be righteous or right with God. Just flip back again, chapter 2, verse 21. Chapter 2, verse 21, Paul says, look, I do not set aside the grace of God. In other words, the good news of Jesus. I do not set aside the grace of God, for, here's the rub, if righteousness could be gained through the law, Christ died for nothing. Is that what you want? Did he really die for nothing? But if we do trust that Christ died for us, well, we belong to a heavenly Jerusalem. We are truly free to have confidence for our eternal future. It's all about believing God's promise to do what we couldn't do ourselves. Not relying on our own attempts to be righteous or right with God. Abraham and Sarah relied on their own attempts to have a family. But God promised them a family. And that was enough. That's why back in chapter 4, as Paul quotes from Isaiah 54, it's a prophecy about God's people in exile in Babylon, and it shows them that God is keeping on promising things to them. He's promising to rescue them and to give them a family. And again, you see, a promise from God is a promise to trust in. So verse 28, you Galatians, you all souls people, you brothers and sisters, you are children of promise. Now those who want to earn their way to heaven will always hate those who trust in God's grace to get them there. They'll persecute them, just as verse 29 says, and Paul says, the issue is clear. They won't like it. But Paul is clear. Do we want to be slaves to our own sin, our inability to be good enough for God, or to be free, to trust in God's promise to forgive us? It's a no-brainer, isn't it? It's obvious which you should choose. Have nothing to do with the Hagar side of the family, Paul says. Rejoice in being on the Sarah side of the family. Now remember, Paul is using these stories of the two women's families as an illustration, but it's a powerful one. And it explains how it is possible for people who are born Jewish and end up as sons and daughters of Abraham and Hagar. And more wonderfully explains how it's possible for people who are born Gentile to end up as sons and daughters of Abraham and Sarah. Because it's not by genetics, it's not by race, it's by grace. You see, the upshot is that I'm a son of Abraham because I trust in Jesus. You are a daughter of Abraham because you trust in Jesus. In him I find freedom. And it is not a matter of my race that saves me. It's a matter of God's grace. And Jesus stands at the fork in the road. The law has always been pointing forward to him. So when I get to him, I must treat the law either as a signpost to him or recognize that it becomes the chains around my neck. So I ask again, do you want to be free or enslaved? If we don't trust him, we're enslaved. We'll find that we do not enjoy the inheritance of Jesus for which Christ died. You see in verse 30, the slave woman's son will never share in the inheritance with the free woman's son. But if we do trust Jesus and live in the way that trusts in his promises, then we are truly free. And because we too easily forget that, we're meeting around the communion table to remember that. As we hear the communion liturgy, as Roger leads us through it, be mindful. Listen out. Listen out for everything that God has promised us and given us by his grace. Amen.